From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Whatever catastrophe life throws at you, whether it's losing your job or your spouse, or maybe just admitting that you're getting older, there comes a time when you have to face facts. This is your life, so what are you going to do about it? We'll hear what sent James McManus off to the Mayo Clinic for an executive physical.
I thought that I was doing fairly well. I'd smoked about a pack a day in my 20s and 30s, got down to half a pack a week in my 40s, but they said, ixnay, no more, and I have lived up to the promise that I made to them.
And why Joanna Trollope was drawn to a mother's experience of an empty nest.
There's a gender difference. You know, if a woman writes about love, it is described by the critics as domestic. If Jay McInerney writes about love, it goes global.
But this story starts with a well-dressed businessman, Michael Gates Gill, dropping into the Starbucks on 78th Street in New York. The man who used to run the creative department at J. Walter Thompson, the most powerful advertising firm in America, had been fired 10 years before. His consulting firm was going nowhere fast. It turned out that this particular Starbucks was hosting a job fair that day, and Crystal, a young black Starbucks manager, sized Michael up and started talking to him.
She said, "Do you know retail?" And I said, "Well, what is retail?" She said, "Well, Walmart." And I said, "Well, I've never been in a Walmart, you know." So I almost lost her there, I think. But I said, "Well, I worked with marketing with Burger King." She said, "Okay, Burger King, you know." So in other words, she was on my side.
To his own amazement, when Crystal offered him a job at Starbucks, Michael Gates Gill took it. He tells the story in a book called How Starbucks Saved My Life, A Son of Privilege Learns to Live Like Everyone Else. Gill told Ann Strainchamps how he came to be in that Upper East Side neighborhood that fateful day.
My parents had a brownstone on 78th Street on the east side of New York, and my mother had said I should take piano lessons, and my father had, I mean, he loved to spend money. His name was Brendan Gill, and he was a famous writer at The New Yorker, but he loved to spend any money he could on anything he could, and he decided that if I was going to take piano lessons, I had to practice on a Steinway Grand. So he immediately went out and bought a Steinway Grand, and then the trick was that it was a little brownstone, and how do you get it in? And he had a crane hired and put it in the French windows on the second story. But all that sort of visual reminded me that I had such a favored place in the universe, and somehow I had fallen so far, and I didn't know how to sort of jog myself out of it. But I did know I could still enjoy a latte. And I looked around and I saw that in place of some childhood shop, there was a new Starbucks. So I went in and sat down at a table and started to sip my latte. And, you know, I hadn't realized it, but there was a job hiring event or something on. And this young woman I happened to sit down next to turned to me and said, "Would you like a job?" And suddenly, I think that helped me break through this sense of denial and inability even to say, "Help, help, I'm drowning." And I said, "Yes, yes, I would like a job." You know, because it's one thing to say you want a job, but I never even filled out a job application. I'd had this one of this affluent background and gone to Yale, and one of my Yale classmates had gotten me my first job in advertising, and so I never had to really do all that. But she helped me, and she said, "You know, do you know retail?" And I said, "Well, what is retail?" She said, "Well, Walmart." And I said, "Well, I've never been in a Walmart, you know." So I almost lost her there, I think, but I think she sensed by that time that I was in need. And she's the kind of person I would never have – she was so different from me in background, education, and everything that I never would have even thought to hire her, because I was always – when I was master of the universe, I'd always like to hire people just like me. And so I was grateful for her. She said, "Okay, is there anything in your – you know, I said, "Well, I was in – worked with marketing with Burger King." She said, "Okay, Burger King." You know, so in other words, she was on my side.
This job was in so many ways – wrong. I mean, wrong status, wrong salary,
right.
Wrong kind of physical
right.
demands, wrong
right.
co-workers, and yet it turned out to be strangely exactly right for you.
Yeah.
How come?
Yeah, I have no idea, and basically I'm still in a sort of wondrous mystery. You know how that sometimes in life I remember one night coming out after closing the Starbucks store and just sort of touching my heart and feeling this level of happiness, which I still have, and I'm not quite sure of why I'm so happy. But I think part of it is, what a relief, you know, Anne, of not having to support this superstructure of status and symbols and all that big lifestyle of mansions and houses and stuff.
What did you do at Starbucks? Like on your first day at work, when you first showed up, what did you do?
Well, You know, Anne, I thought, you know, as you're thinking about now I've accepted this job, but it's going to be so far below me, I'll be embarrassed and humiliated by taking it. But as I saw these young 20-somethings running around and calling out lattes and making change on this cash register and also making some enjoyable conversation, I said, oh, my gosh, this might be way beyond me. I mean, that's scary.
I can and imagine.
Because I was never much very athletic, you know, and I was terrified of money. That's one reason I was there, you know, broke at that age. And so I realized that this is not as easy as it looks. In fact, I discovered it's a lot harder to, you know, create an enjoyable experience for the partners and the guests, you know, making a good cup of coffee than it was to sit around in sort of silly advertising meetings.
The partners and the guests?
You know, words do have power. And we're, even part-timers like myself, are called partners. And, you know, in some corporations, I mean, I had helped many corporations write these mission statements about how they love their people, but somehow they never got around to giving them health insurance or, you know, the key things. And even with part-time partners, you're given health insurance, you're given, and for not just me, but all my children, you're given dental, visual, all these things, but also you're given stock. You don't even ask for it. You're given stock and stock options. In other words, you're made to feel that you are partners. You are part owners of this whole experience. And the other thing is an emotional partnership, which is, you know, when I was working in advertising, it was very competitive and that you felt that there was just a limited number of spaces at the top. So you were always competing. So if someone slipped, it was, you were a little sorry, but that was your opportunity.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning of your book, you talk about how for the first several days, maybe even weeks at Starbucks, you were really terrified of the cash register. And
yes.
So you worked it out so that you basically were on cleaning detail for the first several days or weeks.
Exactly.
Had you ever cleaned anything before?
No, you know, that's very, very perceptive, Ed. Sometimes because I worked late, I would cross paths with cleaning ladies, you know, quote unquote. And at home, I never cleaned either because I was too busy, right? I mean, I was one of these people thinking that running around 100,000 miles a year was doing something. And so, it was a new experience. But the reason, you're absolutely right, Anne, I did it out of fear of that register because that was, you know, I didn't want to be put on it. Luckily, Crystal had some cleaning needs in her store. She said she had a grout problem, but then she said maybe it should be a grout opportunity. But there was grout between the tiles, which is sort of dirty tiles. And I spent days on that. And then once she took me over and showed me how to clean the bathroom. And, you know, there's a lot of peculiar discoveries. You know, you sort of lose these things you find. I found it was therapeutic of me, you know, walk into a messy bathroom and leave it sparkling.
But when you were down on your knees scrubbing a bathroom, did it ever hit you? I used to run the creative department at J. Walter Thompson. What would the people who worked for me say if they could see me now?
Yeah, and actually, one of the gifts of this new, you know, world turned upside down and, you know, I never imagined is I began to laugh at myself because it was funny in a sort of a nice way. And also, it was funny to me that I actually enjoyed it. Because it was something I could do. You know, I'd reached the point in my life where I'd begun to feel like I really didn't have any value. I wasn't useful. And whether it's cleaning a bathroom or doing a lot of, you know, mopping up and doing those kind of things, I felt, hey, I was helping my partner. I was being useful again.
Mm. What about once you finally moved behind the counter? What's that like?
That was really scary. But, and it's good news is that, you know, at Starbucks, and I think probably many establishments today, they have this computer on the register which sort of puts up the right change for you. You know, you put in this, say, $20, and they say, give them back $15.23. And then also it comes up for the guests. So, by the way, I'm still making mistakes. The other day, a guest said, well, Mike, I think you owe me $17, whatever it was, you know? And as you can imagine, I get talking or whatever.
It sounds like you haven't gotten bored yet.
No, I haven't. Each day is still a challenge. Both, you know, you never stop moving, so there's sort of a physical challenge. And I, by the way, I can't say that I leap out of bed at 4 a.m. in the morning or something to, you know, I more or less crawl. But when I get to the store, say at 5, and, you know, all the partners, and we have a cup of coffee, and then we share some with guests, you know, I don't even notice the activity, but I think it's really good for me because it is so physical and demanding. And then after I walk out, I always feel better because, you know, I've had a good time as well as everybody else having a good time.
Sounds like one of the big the big things you learned from working at Starbucks is you really changed your relationship with other people. You were working with people who were not like your former coworkers. They'd had backgrounds that were very, very far from yours.
Right.
They were the kind of people in your former life you probably wouldn't even have been comfortable talking with. And now they were your coworkers, and you were kidding and laughing, and you learned how to have fun with a whole new set of people.
Yeah, that was a huge surprise to me, because I definitely was the minority in the group. I mean, decades older, et cetera. And I realized these people, you know, this is my minority partners, but they became friends to me. They became people I could, that helped me have perspective. You know, I think maybe that's why today I'm happier than I ever have been, aside from losing that strain of, you know, trying to support this sort of status lifestyle. I think the other thing is the freedom of just saying, hey, I'm just a human being like a lot of other human beings. And certainly I discovered I was no better. I was able to sort of have more perspective about myself.
Michael Gates Gill calls his book How Starbucks Saved My Life. And talk about venti-sized irony. Having decided he likes living in a tiny apartment, working part-time, and having a real life, Michael Gates Gill got a phone call from Hollywood film director Gus Van Sant, who wants to make a movie of his life. And oh yeah, Tom Hanks wants to play Michael. James McManus wasn't in bad shape. He wasn't a couch potato, but he didn't like to run or work out regularly. McManus is a novelist and the poker columnist for the New York Times. How much of an athlete do you have to be for that? But he does have young children and a family history of heart disease. So when his editor offered to foot the bill for a 3-day executive physical at the Mayo Clinic, McManus couldn't wait to get into one of those skimpy little hospital gowns. Not that he didn't have some reservations.
It's sort of the last thing you want to do, to get poked and prodded and have your blood tested and stress test and have nurses grab your love handles and twist them and put calipers on them. But the smarter part of you understands that the information is vital, and that especially today, early detection is important. They're not just going to make you feel more comfortable. They can head things off and cure things. And only a fool would not get a checkup if they had the opportunity.
Yeah. You did have some history in your family.
And that's something that the Mayo emphasizes. 2 months before you go up there, they get medical and family history. They don't do a head-to-toe body scan looking at every possible thing. They isolate what are your likely problem areas. My grandfather died of a heart attack at 35 and my father at 61, or of cardiovascular issues, a heart attack and a stroke. So that clearly I needed to get this stuff looked at. I had a high cholesterol count that was being well handled by Zocor. Later turned out that the Zocor was not so friendly to my liver. But that gave me real strong reason to see a cardiologist.
So what's the questionnaire like, the thing that they send you? There's a lot of information that you have
to
give.
Yeah, they want to know how much you used to smoke, do smoke, how much you drink, how many pounds overweight you probably are, what your stress levels are, and then the long thing. Have you ever had this thing going on with your lymph and your skin and your testicles and your toes? And it's very, very complete. And then they want to know when your various grandparents and uncles and aunts, how long they lived, what did they die of. And by that means, they can focus very precisely on what problems you're likely to develop.
The problem I always think I face when I look at those forms is that the objective information is pretty easy to give. When your grandfather died, when your father died, what of. Mm-hmm. It's the subjective stuff. You know,
stress,
when they ask you,
levels.
Yeah, what stress level? Or how much do you drink?
How much you eat and drink. What they want you to do is drink as little alcohol as you can psychologically manage. Some people find it easy to drink, not at all. Other people have wine with dinner more or less every night. And the doctor that I was lucky enough to have, Donald Hensrud, was willing to tailor his advice to the kind of lifestyle that I had gotten used to. And he didn't say, no, you can never drink again. You want to be eating as many green leafy vegetables as possible and as little animal tissue as possible. And you want to be drinking more red wine than Stoli Dolies. And that's Stolichnaya vodka infused with Dole pineapples, which I ran into out in Las Vegas and grew pretty fond of. In any event, they gave me some really good advice. And one of the most interesting aspects of the experience, it was that my cardiologist, Gerald Gao, had a lot of very smart, useful things to tell me about my cardiovascular situation and what I should be doing. And when he asked me to evaluate my stress test, my level of stress, after reading the results of my stress test, I listed my level as high, and he asked me why, and I told him that my son had recently died, and he pretty suddenly stopped treating me with impatience. He was less impatient with his patient, because I had been a little bit I had been more than a little bit lax in my taking care of myself, and he was not real, you know, that I still smoked.
He wasn't sympathetic at
that
point.
He wasn't sympathetic, and the fact that I smoked a cigarette or two a day, but it turned out that he had lost his son fairly recently at a very similar age to my son, so that my heart consultation also became a heart-to-heart, and he heard me a little bit more clearly. Not that he wasn't hearing me clearly earlier.
Did this change your life? I mean, you went in. You said you were under an enormous amount of stress. Your son had just died. You do say that you smoked a little bit more than was a good idea. Mm-hmm. You drank a little bit more than was a good idea. You ate a little bit more than was a good idea.
And exercised a little bit less than I should have. Yeah.
So did it change your life?
Not as radically as it should have. I do eat more salad and vegetables than I did before I went there. I drink quite a bit less hard liquor, much more red wine. I do exercise about the same amount. The most important improvement that I made as the result of talking to those folks was that I quit smoking. And it is the most important controllable variable in your health. They more or less grab you by the lapels and throw you up against the wall, slap you back and forth. Don't ever smoke another bleeping cigarette again. And I thought that I was doing fairly well. I'd smoked about a pack a day in my 20s and 30s, got down to half a pack a week, one a day in my 40s. But they said, ixnay, no more. And I have lived up to that, the promise that I made to them.
I think that this resonates a lot for people who are, especially for the baby boom generation. As you say, you begin to face the death of your parents and the change in health of people you've known all these years. But still, I mean, I'm sort of impressed that you went through this whole thing.
I think it's tough for everybody to face getting middle-aged and older. But I think it's extra tough for people in our generation because we were raised by these people who had gone through the Depression and World War II, and they came back and the country was booming in the 50s and they had all these kids and there was so much optimism in the world and there were so many of us, these people born in the 40s and 50s, that we were led to believe that we were something special. And the youth movement, we got a lot of credit for being young, for not being old. We were told that we were kind of wonderful, and bankers and Pepsi makers and car makers, everybody catered to us. So that now that we have to face aging and mortality, I think it's probably tougher for us than, for example, what I think is accurately called the greatest generation. Those people understood physical and life difficulty better than we do because of the way we were raised. We're a little softer. We're more than a little softer than those folks.
James McManus is the author of the poker book Positively Fifth Street and Physical, an American Checkup. From the time he was a teenager, Glenn Kurtz had his life path planned. The young guitarist saw a future full of concerts and recordings, but it didn't happen, and he put his guitar away for 10 years. What made him pick it up again? We'll find out next.
It's about facing what a loss has meant to you and coming back to it.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. By the time Glenn Kurtz graduated as a guitar major from the New England Conservatory of Music, he was all ready to realize his childhood dream of a big concert career. He'd shown at guitar camp for years. He'd played with Dizzy Gillespie, even appeared in the Merv Griffin show. But in the end, the dream wasn't viable. Glenn Kurtz closed his guitar case, and his life went in another direction. After many years, he picked up his guitar once again, and he rediscovered the joys of music. Now he practices every day. In fact, practice has come to mean so much to him, he's written a book about it. It's called Practicing, A Musician's Return to Music. Steve Paulson asked Glenn Kurtz to bring his guitar with him when they talked.
Is there a difference between just playing informally by yourself and practicing?
Sure, I think there is. I mean, playing, you're just letting yourself play, and you fool around, you do whatever you want, and in a way you take all of the pressure off of yourself. That's what makes it so much fun. You don't care really whether you do a bad job or a good job, you're just enjoying yourself. Practicing is a very focused kind of attention. You're very, very consciously trying to make yourself better. So you're listening very intently for the slightest flaws in your playing, or you're watching very intensely for the slightest wobbling in the muscles of your hands or in your attention, your concentration. You're really trying to rehearse what it means to play music with all of yourself.
So when you practice, how do you begin?
Well, the first thing, of course, is I tune the instrument. And on humid days in New York, sometimes that can take quite a while. And then I loosen up my hands. First, I do a series of exercises for my right hand, and then a series for my left hand, and then a couple that make them work together in different combinations so that, you know, all the connections get made and everything starts working together.
So you have to warm up the body for it to perform.
Sure,
correctly.
It's a very physical thing, of course. It's like being an athlete, except it's concentrated in your hands.
So what is the goal of practice? Is it to hone your technical skill or just to try to keep it at the level where it has been? Or is it to learn new techniques? So what are you trying to do here?
Well, it's all of the above. For the vast majority of musicians, I think it's always to improve your technique. Maybe there are some people whose technique is already so perfect that all they need to really do is maintain it. But I don't think that that's really the case. I mean, and technique doesn't exist independently. I mean, it does in some sense if you're playing scales. But the purpose of technique is to allow you to play music the way you want to. And so there's always refinements in how you play that you're trying to achieve because you hear something differently or you hear a nuance or you want to create an effect that requires something of you that maybe you didn't know how to do. So depending on what you're working on, sometimes you just do technique to warm up, sometimes you do technique to address a problem that's crept in, and sometimes you do technique in a very specific way to try and learn a new way of moving or create a new kind of effect with your playing.
And what about the guitar itself? Can that change throughout a session of practicing?
Sure, it does. Any instrument, especially a wooden instrument. But even, I think, even electronic instruments, they are very responsive to the body, to the warmth of the body, to being played over a long period of time, particularly a guitar and violins. Any wooden instrument that's very finely balanced is very, very sensitive to humidity and air pressure. So over the course of any practice session, the instrument itself changes tremendously.
That suggests that the guitar itself could have a bad day.
It does, of course. And it's very much like another person. You both have moods when you sit down together, and you have to approach each other cautiously and get to know what's happening and where you're both at, and hopefully you find some common ground in which to work.
It's so interesting hearing you describe all of this, because clearly you take great pleasure in this whole process, the whole business of getting warmed up and then just feeling the instrument in your hand and playing and showing mastery, which I'm just thinking about my own kids who, when they have to practice playing the piano, it's, you know, anything but fun. But it makes one wonder how you get from there to here.
I don't remember ever disliking practicing, although I probably didn't really start practicing until somewhat later. I just loved playing, and that was what I did, and that was what I did instead of practicing for many years. But yeah, it's a great pleasure and a great misery. And yet somehow the challenges of it, emotional challenges, the physical challenges, to say nothing of just the musical challenges, it's a tremendous delight. It demands so much of you, of me, of my intelligence and my sensitivity and my ear and my physicality. And to get them all working together, yeah, it's just the greatest feeling there is.
You have a passage in your book where you talk about practicing and how that's different from performing. Could you read that?
Sure. Yeah, this is towards the end of the book, in my practice session when I'm just finishing and I perform a piece of music. And this is right when I've done. I sit with the final notes, feeling the surprising shape of this music. I've given everything I can give now, a performance. Perhaps I am my only audience today, and my attention alone makes this a performance and not just playing in my room. But attention changes everything. I have to laugh and wonder. I've found a new story of practicing, though it's not the one I expected when I sat down this morning. Practicing, I might repeat a note, a section, a whole piece, 100 times, as if I had all the time in the world to play. This bit of pretending allows me to escape the urgency of each instant and improve slowly. Yet each instant is urgent, and in the end, practicing is a lie. It's a necessary lie. A fiction that suspends time so we may examine and reflect on what we do or who we are, but still alive. Music lives only in performance. Only then does what we hear become real. Performing reveals everything we are able to show, and yet for this reason, the first time through, we often perform badly. And we yearn so deeply to go back again and correct our mistakes. Few yearnings are as profound in us, because the truth is, we cannot go back. Yet the fiction of practicing makes it seem as if we can, and this is enough to change our lives. Practice lets us grow in our own time, protected from the demands, the vitality and mortality of each moment. Within the practice room walls, it often seems as if time really does stand still, as if we could always remain protected, practicing, and improving forever. This illusion holds transformative power, but also a dangerous seduction. Practice, by itself, is a dream of perfection. Only performing can turn practice into shared life, where our own time may join with others, becoming musical. Yet practicing is the necessary lie that lets us pause to collect ourselves. It's the inner life of performance, the inward turn that allows us to develop, to grow, to move forward having learned.
Oh, it's a wonderful passage. And it raises some rather obvious questions. It suggests that the whole point of practicing is so that you will perform.
I think that that's true. I mean, I think whether you perform for yourself, as I am in this passage, or whether you're doing your debut at Carnegie Hall, I think that practice alone can become a very sterile thing. And it makes you think that you can, like I say in this passage, you can remain protected, improving forever, stopping time somehow, and not changing. But I think even if you're alone, if you never step in front of another person, at some point you want to take what you've practiced and try and do it for real. And that sense of doing it for real is a completely different feeling than practicing, where you feel like it's sort of tentative, or you're putting it together, or you're trying it out. But when you really put all of yourself in it, that becomes a performance naturally. And I think that we all do that. It doesn't matter whether we're playing an instrument or, you know, whether you're learning to cook, there are times when it's for real. And that's when, yeah, that's when real life happens.
Is this partly a story about aging? I mean, could you only have come to this point being as old as you are right now?
My august age. I think so. I mean, I think in some sense it is. And maybe not aging per se, but maturing, certainly. I think in many ways the story is about getting over myself as a child. And it happened that I was relatively precocious and I had some success. And I conceived this ideal for myself that built upon that success. And it turned out to be unsustainable, as so many childhood dreams are. And yeah, the fact that it was a childhood dream didn't make it any less painful to lose. But I had to come back to it later. I mean, this can happen to you when you're 12 years old. It can happen to you when you're 70. It's about facing what a loss has meant to you and coming back to it. This idea of returning seems to me so central. And I think it's central to practicing, what practicing is, because you're striving every day for something that maybe you won't achieve. And it's possible to leave the practice room every single day feeling like you failed. And yet, you come back the next day and you try again. And I think that there's something about that process of returning, of facing yourself realistically, even if you haven't lived up to your own ideals, and trying again. That's, in some way, that's almost the definition of maturity.
Glenn Kurtz is the author of Practicing, A Musician's Return to Music. He talked with Steve Paulson. Do you practice? And what does your practice bring to your life? We'd love to know. Send us an email through our website. It's at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When it comes to writing about modern family life, nobody does it better than Joanna Trollope. In Second Honeymoon, her 17th domestic drama, the plot is set in motion by a young man's decision to leave home. His parents, Edie and Russell, are left with an empty nest and each other.
"Look," Edie said, "I'm sorry." She had made tea in the big pot with cabbage roses on it. It was extremely vulgar, but it had intense associations for Edie, as everything in her life did, everything that reminded her of a place, a person, a happening. She said, "I was fed up with you because you wouldn't understand." "I do understand," Russell said. "Do you?" He nodded, tensing slightly. "Then tell me," Edie demanded. "Explain what is the matter." Russell paused, and then he said, "It's the end of a particularly compelling and urgent phase of motherhood for you. And it's very hard to adjust to." "I don't want to adjust," Edie said. "I want Ben back." Russell poured milk into his tea. "I want him back," Edie said fiercely. "I want him back to make me laugh and infuriate me and exploit me and make me feel necessary." Russell picked up his teacup and held it, cradling it in his palms. "I've been out there in the shed," Russell said, "for about 3 hours. I've been sifting through all sorts of rubbish, things that mattered once and don't anymore, and that's quite painful, knowing things won't come again, knowing things are over forever. But wait," Russell said, "just wait. Rosa's not going to ride that trike again. Matt's not going to hit with that bat. You're not going to read under that lampshade. That's not comfortable. That's not easy to know, to have to accept, but we have to, because we have no choice. And we also have something left." Edie took a long swallow of tea and looked at him over the rim of her cup. "You talk about wanting Ben back," Russell said. "You talk about his energy and neediness and the way it makes you feel. Well, just think for a moment about how I feel. I didn't marry you in order to have Matt and Rosa and Ben, though I'm thankful we did. I married you because I wanted to be with you. Because you somehow make things shine for me, even when you're horrible. You want Ben back. Well, you'll have to deal with that as best you can. And while you're dealing with it, I'll give you something else to think about, something that isn't going to go away. Edie, I want you back.
Joanna Trollope, that's really very lovely. And it makes me wonder if we caused our mothers that much pain when we left home. It seems to me maybe it was easier to grow up when we were young.
My generation left home pretty comprehensively. I mean, we took every last paperback with us when we went. And I think our parents often then turned our bedrooms into something quite different behind our backs, you know. And we went out into a world of pretty certain employment. We considered ourselves launched, really. And I think the world is a much more alarming and harsh place for the young now. And so inevitably, they go out into it much more tentatively. It's quite endearing, really, isn't it? They go leaving their bedrooms looking as they've looked for the last 22 years, you know, all ready to come back to. And they go taking a toothbrush and an iPod. And the moment something goes wrong, they go back. Whereas in past generations, you had lots of children in order for those children to look after you in your old age. Now the tables seem to be turned and the parents go on and on looking after the children. Because it is much harder for them. I think the world's a much more alarming place than it was a generation or two ago. So it seemed to be rather a moment to write about it, because it's always been a huge turning point for women, but it's now huge for everybody. It's as significant for the generation that's leaving as it is for the generation being left.
Well, it's curious the way you describe it, because you seem to have a great deal of sympathy for the young people who are leaving and coming back, and yet...
Oh, I do.
There is in this book that you've written also some question about whether the generation that is being left has found ways to handle it. You'd think that those of us of the generation that did, as you say, leave home quite comfortably, you'd think that we would be happy to see our children go, but it's somehow not true.
Well, don't you think the general social attitudes towards parenting have changed? I mean, when my children were little, and they're now in their mid-30s, so, you know, it's a long time ago, there was Dr. Spock for when they were ill, and there was Dr. Penelope Leach for their conduct. Now the parenting instruction manuals fill whole sections of bookshops. There's a sort of notion out there that there's a way of getting parenting right, and of course there isn't. You know, it's different in every situation. So parenting's become more anxious. There's more pressure to get it right, as if you ever could. It's also become more sentimental, this idea of letting children go. Instead of seeing children as people who are lent to you for the duration of their maturity, and your job is to launch them as independent citizens, they're seen almost as an extension of yourself, therefore letting them go is much harder. And I think it's quite difficult to be the children of such sentimental parents. I think we need to get off their backs a bit.
So when you began to approach this subject, you created Edie and Russell, the parents
Yes.
of this extended family. And there is a kind of classic problem, which you set up very early in the book, that Edie wants her children to stay, and Russell is glad to have them gone, but loves them very much, but really wants
Yes.
Edie back. Who's fooling
yes, he
whom?
Does. He's the grown-up. He understands. I mean, he's tired also of, I think, of funding his children eternally. You know, he's been financially supporting them all for well over a quarter of a century, and he's rather weary of that. Yes, he wants his marriage back. And he's very plain about it, and Edie's rather afraid of having her marriage back. The role of mother always suited her. I mean, she's an actress. She's a good but not a great actress. And, of course, the theatre is a notoriously perilous and rejecting profession. So all her life she's been able to say, yes, I am an actress and I will accept that part, but only if it fits in with being a mother. She's always had motherhood to be her excuse, so she doesn't need to expose herself to quite all the perils of her profession. And now she's left without that comfortable buffer. Now she's got to face the world of work again. And she's very nervous about doing it. And she's nervous about being left alone with Russell again. She's nervous about this identity vanishing. So being an actress, she makes a three-act drama of it at home. And I intend her to be quite exasperating. Yes. You know, she's pretty theatrical about most things.
I think you've succeeded at that, actually.
Yeah, she's very annoying, isn't she?
Yes.
I know that I've had a lot of letters from English women saying, how do I find a Russell of my own? How do I find a steady, grown-up, patient man like this?
Well, of course, that's a classic question that that you're not forced to answer. Luckily.
No, no. I'm afraid it's not my responsibility.
But it is your responsibility to take on the way in which people live their lives, and especially because you seem clearly interested in it, the way in which women approach the modern world, which involves work.
And this extraordinary capacity that so many women seem to have, which is to reinvent themselves. And women seem to go on doing that all their lives. I mean, it's one of the female qualities which I think disconcerts men so much. But women returners to work have a kind of flexibility of approach, which I have to say, fond though I am of men, you don't see in the other gender quite so much. And once Edie's launched, once she's got the hang of acting again, wry laughter from the other microphone, she finds she loves it. She'd forgotten what it felt like to be good at something that you're paid for. And that's an enormously gratifying situation to be in.
Joanna Trollope calls her 17th novel about modern family life Second Honeymoon. It's out now in paperback. Carl Claus wasn't ready to become a widower. He missed his wife so much that he wrote her almost daily letters for a year after she died. Letters like this.
Thursday, December 5. Dear Kate, every day this week I'm having lunch or dinner with one of our friends. So many invitations that I feel like a social butterfly. But the flurry of invitations will probably dry up so quickly that I'll wish I hadn't been worrying about it. Still, I can't help feeling there's something wrong with my going out like this so soon after your death, especially when I think of your mother's lonely vigil in the wake of your father's death. Maybe it's also my childhood memory of how we all wore black armbands for several months after my Uncle Manny died, but something deep within me makes me feel as if I'm breaking a taboo. Yet it's hard to say no, and not just because I don't want to turn away our friends, but also because I don't want to spend my days and nights alone without any kind of companionship. You'd know exactly what to do in this situation, and you'd do it without all this fretting. Isn't it ridiculous? I'm 70 years old and don't know how to behave without you.
Carl Claus has compiled those letters into a book called Letters to Kate, Life After Life. He still remembers every detail of their last day together.
She had gone off that morning to an art fair. She was planning to buy some Christmas gifts, pieces of pottery, jewelry. She'd come home at about 1 in the afternoon, and I said, well, don't worry. I'll have lunch ready in just a few minutes. I was boiling some pasta, in fact, for some spaghetti that I had made for lunch. And when I turned around, I noticed her standing by the oven, staring into the wall of the oven blankly, and it was so blank that I thought that there was something wrong, and I said, are you okay? And she said, oh, yes, I'm just hungry. I have a little headache, but I'm sure that food will take care of everything. And so I turned around to stir the spaghetti again and then looked back again, and there she was still staring blankly at the oven. And then suddenly the strangest expression started passing over her face, one so tender that I don't think I'd ever seen anything like it before, and then one so pained, once again, that I never had seen anything like it before, and then one so blank that it seemed as if she were a million miles away. And I said, I think that there's something wrong. Let me call 911. And then I knew that we were really in bad trouble, and I went to the phone and called 911, and they were out in 5 minutes because the ambulance is stationed at a hospital just about 6-7 blocks from us. And while they were there, she was still talking, though she had fallen out of the chair in the interim between my calling the ambulance and it arriving. But one of the medics said, her vital signs are good, don't worry. And I thought about coming down in the ambulance, and they said, no, you can just drive down in a car. So though I knew that this was something very, very serious, I also thought that it was something that could be dealt with. I had no idea that she might be dead 3 hours later.
When did you begin writing to her after her death? Was it right away?
I began writing to her a week after she died, and I started without any kind of premeditation. I had gone up to our TV room where there are a couple of chairs. I was alone, I should add, for the first time that week. My children had gone home. Her sister had gone home. All the friends and relatives who had swept through the house that week had taken their ways. And I was alone for the first time, and I just went up to sit in her chair, pulled a tablet out of a basket that she kept by the side of the chair to write in, because she was always writing. And suddenly I found myself writing her a letter. And it was without any intention to do so. It was as if the muse had descended upon me and I was not free not to write.
Now, you've kept a journal for years, haven't you? You and Kate have done that.
Yes, we had both kept journals, and I had turned several of my journals into books. And I had, the last year that I was teaching, taught a course in the art of the journal, where I had suggested to my graduate students that perhaps the best thing they could do to give a journal a sense of focus was to center their entries on some crisis in their life.
But still, so keeping a journal was something you were accustomed to, and this is different. I mean, the logical thing, it seems to me, would have been for you to sit down and do what you'd always done, to express yourself to your book. But instead, something made you talk to Kate instead.
Right, exactly so. And, you know, I didn't realize it until later, but in part, it was simply a deep existential need to be in touch as we had been every day of our lives for the 35 years we had been married and the 2 years before that I had been courting her, when at the end of every day I told her, as she would ask me, so what happened today? And I, in turn, would say to her, so what happened? We shared our days, and we had a marriage that was very, very close, quite intimate, so much so that we were rarely ever apart.
One of the things that I think people are shocked by, it seems to me anyway, and perhaps you can correct me, is that we expect there to be lots of help dealing with grief, that there should be, especially for writers, there should be lots of books about dealing with this. But there aren't really, are there?
Yeah, that's the paradox, in fact, of memory, that it is at once a source of anguish in that it keeps our grief green, but on the other hand, it's a source of great strength in that it reminds us of all of the power, all of the love, all of the beauty, and all of the gifts that that person has given us. And over the course of the year, it was that aspect of memory that came to save me and actually to give me strength that I never imagined I had had before, because I suddenly realized that in a strange sense, it was as if she had been preparing me all the days of our time together to survive without her. The daily act of writing her enabled me not just to keep in touch, as it were, but to keep drawing on the extraordinarily rich bank of memories that I had, and that forced me to keep confronting the problems and issues that are raised by the death of anyone, and that led me to thoughts about death and about life and the meaning of both that I never would have had otherwise.
Of course, one of the things people tell you is that the first year is going to be the hardest, and so in some ways you spent an intense year maintaining contact with Kate. Did it change when the anniversary of her death finally came around?
Well, it changed just slightly before the anniversary. She died on November 23rd. About a week before, I had gone to a place in Hawaii where Kate and I had often vacationed, Hanalei Bay on the north shore of Kauai, to scatter her ashes with my daughters, with her sister, with a friend who's a resident of the islands. And I had been holding her ashes, in other words, for an entire year, and imagined that this would be a beautiful place to scatter them and a place that would be befitting, as I saw it, her beauty. And so that day, scattering the ashes, was the day in which I found an extraordinarily powerful sense of relief, unburdening, that I had never imagined could possibly come from such an event. And in part it was because of the strange beauty of that bay, of the mountains that back it, but also of the appearance of the ashes as they hit the water, almost diving in streaks down to the bottom, as if suddenly she had been brought to life again by the infusion of water into her ashes, but also by the strange and inexplicable phenomenon that came at the conclusion of it when the captain of the outrigger who had taken us out invited us just to take a few minutes to think about what we had done. We had also cast lays upon the water, an ancient Hawaiian tradition, lay upon lay upon lay upon the water, which itself was gorgeous to behold. But at the climax then, just after he told us to take a few minutes to think about the experience, suddenly a rainbow appeared over the mountains, a rainbow without rain. And we were all simply swept away by that phenomenon that simply cannot be explained except in some kind of otherworldly working of her powers. She was an extraordinary writer and dramatist, and she, I imagine, wanted to have commandeered the moment.
Carl Claus is the author of Letters to Kate. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 107A, Facing the Rest of Your Life. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.